Hello, friends, and welcome to the show. This episode of HR Oxygen is brought to you by the brand new Boss Builders University. Now, what we did is we combined some of the best programs we have, which of course is our Boss Builder Academy, which many folks are using right now for management development. But we've also added a component for you, the HR professional, who is really looking to grow professionally and also needs to get those ever-important SHRM and HRCI credits. What we did is we put some of our best stuff together and we put it into a format where you can download and watch on demand. We are constantly adding to that catalog of great audio and video programs, all designed to help you grow professionally. To check out what we have, go to bossbuildersuniversity.com and you can click the drop downs. If you have any questions, just reach out to us at mac@thebossbuilders.com. Now, for this episode, we're going to deviate from what we normally talk about on HR Oxygen. We do like to talk about some HR technical things, so we like to talk about ways to build your skills, but every now and then we want to put somebody on the show who has an inspirational story to share. And that person today is my friend Nicole Bard. Now, I'm not going to tell you how I met her in all sorts of detail because we go into that, but in working with her on something else, I discovered something amazing about her. She is the recipient of a liver transplant from a living donor. Her story is fascinating, and I don't care how bad your day is today, there is no possible way you will ever have the kind of tough days that Nicole's had on this journey. Just when you think it can't get any worse, it does. The best news is that she has come through this with flying colors. She is an inspiration. And so I'm just going to quit talking about Nicole. I'm going to let her tell her story. So you know what to do, right? I want you to buckle up, put the personal item under the seat in front of you. It's time to take off.
Should the cabin lose pressure, oxygen masks will drop from the overhead area. Please place the mask over your own mouth and nose before assisting others. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the HR Oxygen Podcast, the show focused on the overworked, overwhelmed, and underappreciated HR professional. And now, here is the host of our show, the Boss Builder, Mac Monroe.
Nicole Bard, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So just to kind of fill in the listeners for why we're doing this today, first of all, Nicole, you don't work in human resources, so people would wonder, why are we having Nicole on the show? Well, I actually was talking with Nicole sort of on a professional level, and she just happened to offhandedly mention that she was recovering from a liver transplant. And so I didn't know much about that. And so we started talking about that. Well, it turns out she has a fascinating story and really a medical procedure that I had no idea existed. But I think it's important that people realize it does exist. So Nicole, I'm not going to be doing a lot of talking on this show. I want you to tell the story. You are a recipient from a live donor of a liver, right?
Yes, I am. Yes, that's pretty amazing.
I mean, the way I asked it, I said, you know, do you know anything about the donor? You're like, yeah, she's my best friend. I'm like, oh my God, I'm sorry. No, she's alive. So, you know, it was just something different for me. So Nicole, I want to hear the whole story. So I want to go back to when you knew that something was not right and you needed, you know, a new liver. Tell us about that. Tell us the entire story.
Well, it actually starts back pretty far. From about the time that I was 6 years old, I was pretty ill. I would get really, really sick a few times a year and just was low energy and not feeling well majority of the time. And we went from doctor to doctor for years and years. And it wasn't until I was in high school, probably about my sophomore year, that we finally found a diagnosis. So it started off with a Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis diagnosis. But then we noticed that my liver levels, my enzymes in my liver were still high, even though I was receiving treatment. So they did a liver biopsy and discovered that I had this rare liver disease. Actually, at the time, I was misdiagnosed of having a condition called autoimmune hepatitis. And I was told that within 10 to 20 years, I would need a liver transplant. for years and years and years, I didn't have any symptoms. So it was kind of a back thought in my mind. Every once in a while, I would look up this disease that I supposedly had and just to get some information. But then I just kind of put it back in the back of my head and left it there. Until about 2016, I started to show symptoms. I started to have extreme fatigue. It feels like you have the flu basically all the time. Your body aches. Your comprehension is very low. I would literally get home from work and just crash. And itchiness, pruritus, it's all over my entire body. I would be itchy all the time. Those are kind of the main symptoms. And then occasional jaundice as well, which is yellowing of the skin and eyes. So I started to see some specialists, some hepatologists. I started going to Yale, and we discovered that I didn't have autoimmune hepatitis. I had primary sclerosing cholangitis. Say that 10 times fast.
Yeah, say that again. What was that?
So it's primary sclerosing cholangitis. We call it PSC for short, and I'm sure
you can tell why. I like that better, yeah, PSC, yeah.
Yes, I actually had to practice that when they diagnosed me. I was like, wait, can you just break that down?
You wonder who comes up with these names, don't you?
Yeah, I know. It's pretty crazy. Yes. So we definitely shorten it to PSC, which is a much easier and more recognizable name. So it's a variation. It's similar to the autoimmune hepatitis, but it attacks, it's basically an autoimmune disease where your body is attacking itself. And specifically the biliary tree and bile ducts in and outside the liver. So your body recognizes it as some sort of foreign entity that's not supposed to be there, so it attacks it. And it causes scar tissue over time, which is fibrosis, and then eventually leads to cirrhosis, which is when parts of the liver are dead. The liver is an amazing organ that can actually regenerate itself. And so when somebody has damage, it can actually heal itself. But when it's repeated consistent damage like this, when your body is constantly attacking it for years and years and years, it builds up and eventually leads to liver failure. So in 2017, it started to progress very, very quickly. It's a very unpredictable disease, and some people can live with it forever and not know and not have any issues. Other people, it can be up and down like a roller coaster. And then other people, it can progress very, very quickly. So within a 2-year span of time, we were working on getting me on the transplant list. This disease is unique in the way that the symptoms can be so debilitating that even if you don't have end-stage liver disease, you could need a liver transplant. So because when you have itching and things like this and you literally can't sleep at night, you know, you become so sleep deprived, your quality of life is very, very minimal. You get reoccurring infections. I was going in for procedures every 3 weeks to try and clear out my passageways in my liver to try and keep it functioning enough. So I technically was on the liver transplant list, but my MELD score, which is what they use to decide where you are on the list, was actually very low. So I wasn't a really good candidate for a deceased donor, but I was living with all of these ailments constantly. And
so let me ask you about the list. Is it, I mean, can you go online and see like, oh, I was 200 yesterday, I'm at 196 today. Do you have access to that?
I did not. I actually couldn't tell you if that is possible because we never really went into that. I was told that my MELD score was almost normal. So it was very, very unlikely that I would get a deceased donor. So I didn't really research that very much. So that would definitely be something interesting to find out. I know that based on your score, is, you know, how high or low you are on the list, but I don't know if there's an actual physical visible list that you can see.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you couldn't, but I always have these, you know, like if I had enough money, could I buy like 10 spots up on the list? I probably just watch too much TV, I guess.
No, you cannot. However, you can petition for points for certain things. So they actually petitioned for points from me because of my condition and because of my debilitating symptoms. So they petitioned. It's UNOS is the... is where all of this is tracked. And they asked for additional points for me because of my condition, but it was not awarded to me. Okay. But there are certain circumstances like cancer and things like that where they can use to kind of put you higher on the list. So they did tell me that I had one really good option because I wasn't very severely sick to the point where I wouldn't be able to survive a surgery. I was a good candidate for a living donor, which, like you, Mac, I had no idea existed. How can you receive a living donor liver transplant?
And I know you can do kidneys, but yep. I'd never heard of liver. Never.
Yes, I had heard of kidneys because you have two. It's logical. You can give one away and you can still function with one. We understand that. With a liver, you can actually give half of a liver or a portion of a liver. So somebody can elect to give away part of their liver. And the even more amazing thing is that both pieces will, within like 12 weeks of surgery, will have regenerated into full livers.
So how big is the piece? Because I'm thinking a human liver, I don't know, maybe it's the size of a big softball or something. I mean, I don't know, but.
So it's actually the largest internal organ and it spans a good way across your abdomen. So it's actually a very large organ. And my friend actually donated 2/3 of her liver to me.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Because that was the portion that I needed. So yes. So these two portions of livers, like this one liver turned into two, basically.
So I'm probably jumping ahead of the story, but you have me intrigued. So did they basically take that 2/3 chunk and replace what you had with that? Or did they staple that onto the other one? How did that work?
They removed the damaged liver and they gave me the new one. Yeah. So it's...
Okay. Well, I'm jumping ahead because I want to... Yeah. So you just found out that you could actually do this living donor procedure. So what was your next step then, besides thinking, oh my God, that's great news?
Well, so once we had gotten me listed and everything, I could start basically advocating for myself. You, in this sort of situation, you know, it's altruistic. So somebody has to want to do it. And somebody has to come forward and say, I'm willing to get tested for this person. So I had to basically advertise it. You know, I need a liver transplant. I have this rare disease. I need help. Please, if you know anybody who's willing to, or if you're willing to call and get tested for me, you know, please do so.
So that's why you put that word out.
Actually, I did it mostly through social media. And I'm actually not a person who goes on social media very often. And I tend to be kind of private when it comes to my medical concerns, or at least I used to be. But I recognized that for my best chance at surviving this, I had to tell my story, and I had to step out of my comfort zone and let people know what was going on in my life. So I, you know, put posts out on Facebook and you know, Instagram, everything that I could think of, and just spread the word, please. That's why, like, you may see on a car or a billboard, you know, I need a kidney or something like that, or call this number, my sister needs a kidney. So it was the same sort of thing. You kind of almost have to find it yourself. And
I was very, very lucky, very blessed that I had over 30 people call in for me.
Wow. And did you know these 30 or were these random strangers?
Actually, the majority of them I knew.
Okay.
And actually the majority of them were people that I participate in community theater with.
Oh, okay, good. So with this too, Nicole, I mean, do you have a close family, married, children, anything like that?
I do. I am married and I have 2.5-year-old twins. So, wow.
So how did your husband, and obviously your twins were probably too young to know this. What was that like when you had to share that news?
My husband, Peter, knew when he met me that I had this condition and that I was chronically ill. So we kind of knew this was coming. It came a lot faster than we expected or anticipated. It was challenging how quickly it progressed. But my husband was extremely supportive. I know the process was extremely scary and hard for him as well, but he was right there for me, advocating, if not more than me, the whole time. And my children were young, but they did understand, I think, to a degree, as much as they could. Mm-hmm. They would say things like, "Mommy's going to the doctor," or, you know, "Mommy boo-boo." Like, they couldn't sit on my lap or something because of my abdomen pain.
Right.
So they were very receptive of it, even though they didn't obviously fully understand what was going on.
Wow. So you have 30 people who have come forward. So what is the next step then?
So the next step is they choose, based on a survey. So basically you call in, you say, "I would like to be tested for this person." They ask you a ton of questions, very invasive, very personal questions, because they basically have to know everything about you. And then if you've passed that step and they feel like you could potentially be a good match, you go for a blood test to see if you're a match on that level. Once they have that, they pick, if you have a variety of people, like I did, thankfully, they pick the person who they feel is potentially the best match, and they go through a series of testing. It's an intensive 2-day testing where they basically do CAT scans, MRIs, blood work, stress test, echocardiogram, everything you can think of, like basically just the best physical you've ever had in your life, most thorough physical. And they can only do that to one person at a time. Once they've done that, they meet as a team and they determine whether or not they feel that this person is a good match or a potential person for the surgery. It's very important when somebody is doing an elective surgery like this, that they make sure that they have the best possible outcome and they want to ensure their safety going into it.
So that level of tests, does the potential donor pay for that? How does that work?
No, actually the recipient's insurance covers everything for the donor. So anybody who got tested, and then actually my donor and her procedure and everything is covered by my insurance.
Okay.
Yeah. So they don't have to pay a thing. The only thing that would impact them is time away from work, you know, that sort of thing. But as far as like medical payments, they don't pay anything.
Okay. So of the 30 candidates, it came down to just one, right?
We had a few along the way that were potentially looking very good. And we had one that was deferred a few times. And it came down to a few different things, some physiological things. I had a friend who was nearly a match, but he had an extra bile duct. And because of that, it was nothing that would hurt him in his lifetime, but it would complicate the surgery. So he was removed from the options. I had a friend who needed to lose some weight and get her cholesterol under control a little bit. So they deferred her a few times. And there was another physiological one that I something about an extra vein or something. And then, so after months of going through this process and, you know, are they a match? Aren't they a match? Can we go forward? They finally said that my one friend who needed to lose some weight and get cholesterol under control had reached the goals that they felt made it safe for her to proceed with the surgery. And my best friend, Christina, was deemed a match for me, and we were able to schedule surgery.
Wow. How did she feel when she was selected?
You know, it's kind of a funny story because I've known her for probably 12 to 15 years, and she's known this entire time that I eventually would need a liver transplant, and she wanted to donate to me from the beginning. And actually, when we started this process and I was finally given the go ahead to start telling people to call in, I actually invited her over and asked her if she would be the first person to go through the process for me, that I wanted her to try first. Just because we were so close, so connected, such good friends. She just is an amazing person, which I'm sure you can imagine based on what she has done for just a friend. And she was deferred, so we were a little, you know, a little bummed about that, but then she ended up being the one. So it just made our hearts really happy that I would be receiving my liver from her. And she was just beyond ecstatic, and that she would get to do that for me.
Now, did she have family? Did they have to weigh in on it too? Or was it just completely her decision and nobody said anything?
It is her decision. However, you do need to have a strong support system. And that is one of the factors that they consider when going into this on the recipient and donor side. I also had to have a strong support system or they wouldn't list me, because after surgery, there's a lot. It's very involved and you cannot take care of yourself in a lot of ways. You know, you're going to clinic a few times a week and you can't drive yourself. So from as basic as you need somebody to drive you to these appointments to, you know, making sure that you're taking your meds correctly, you need somebody there. Mm-hmm. So she needed a support system as well. And it worked out really great. It was really perfect because she worked from home at the time. And she had just recently moved back in with her parents temporarily. So she had her parents right there to support her. Right. And they agreed with her decision and were happy. Of course, they were a little nervous for her, going into such an intense surgery. But they knew the risks and they knew that these surgeries are so successful, that they, you know, had high hopes and that they were supporting her and backing her every step of the way. And actually an interesting fact about like survival rates, et cetera, success rates, is that if a transplant, a living transplant location, the hospital, doesn't meet a certain success rate, they will be shut down. So, wow. And I think it's like 98% or higher. Like it's very, very strict. They have these procedures and these surgeries down to an exact science, and the success rates are just astronomical because they know what they're doing. So that's always very reassuring.
Yeah. Wow. So she's been selected. Now is the next step. They put a date on the calendar. How did it happen?
Yes. Then it was, well, we have the surgeons that we need available this day.
Well, it almost sounds like, okay. You're like, I'm thinking about the the rocket that went up into space this past weekend. It almost sounds like you're planning this mission, right?
Yes, it is very similar to that in the sense that not only that, but so many little things, like if any little circumstance changes, it can cancel the surgery. So if I got sick, if she got sick, if, you know, one of the surgeons was no longer available, if I had some sort of infection, or like there were a lot of, or if she just decided she didn't want to do it anymore, you know, there was a lot of circumstances that could prevent it from happening. And then it was would be like going back to the drawing board and, you know, figuring out. Oh, again.
I can't imagine how hard that would be for you too.
Yeah. I think my biggest fear going into surgery was that it wouldn't happen.
What is the amount of time? I mean, was it a couple of weeks when she was selected to when the surgery was going to go down? How long was that wait?
Yeah, it was a few weeks for us.
Okay.
And our surgery was on October 15th, 2019. So yes, I just remember waiting for that day. And just, I mean, my nurse, my transplant nurse at the time told me, she said, don't even get, you know, a hangnail or anything, because I don't want you to get any sort of potential infection that will cancel this for you.
Wow. Yeah.
It was a little bit uncertain there for a little bit.
So take us to the morning then. Did you have to get in real early, you and your donor, and you sit there and fill the paperwork out? I mean, how did all that happen?
We did have to go early in the morning. We each had a few people with us. It was kind of a surreal experience. She had her parents with her. I had my mother, my sister, my brother, my dad, and my stepmom. And basically, you're taken back, and you're sent in separate directions. So her surgery and my surgery had to be completely different, completely separate. And actually, we were in the unique situation that we knew each other and we knew each other well. So usually there's a lot of confidentiality. They don't tell you who the person is. They don't tell you anything about them, just if they're a match or not, if they're willing to do it or not. And we knew each other, so nothing was confidential between the two of us. And so we stood there in the hallway and, you know, gave each other one final hug before we went our separate ways. And then I was in a waiting room where people were allowed to come in and see me one at a time. So my family came in one at a time and wished me luck. And, you know, it was a little bittersweet because everybody was hoping that they would see me on the other side.
Right,
and
right.
So it was very emotional. But I was so excited and so relieved to be going into this surgery and having this opportunity.
So they put you on the gurney, probably start an IV, and they wheel you in there. And what's the last thing you remember before you went out?
You know, I remember walking down the hallway to go to surgery and seeing my transplant nurse and giving her a hug and being like, I'm here. We made it. We're doing it. And that's the last thing I remember. And that's probably because, you know, you're so heavily medicated in the procedure and your body goes through so much trauma that I didn't even remember that until recently.
Wow.
For a long time, I had forgotten about that morning.
So how long did the procedure take?
I think it took like 7 or 8 hours.
Wow. 7 or 8 hours?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
It's very extensive because they're basically, for me, they're doing two surgeries. So they're removing the liver. And then they're giving me the new one and making all of the connections. So it was very involved and very extensive. They have two transplant surgeons in each operating room. So Christina had two and I had two. So we basically have to have four people who are certified and specialize in living donor liver transplant to have this happen.
So Christina probably would have been not put under right away. I'm sure they had to probably, because I guess it would take a couple hours to remove yours. And then do they give this, I mean, you're sleeping, so you don't know the answer to this, unless you ask later. Did they give the signal?
They actually happen simultaneously.
Oh, do they? Okay.
While they're removing hers, they're removing mine. So they start off at the same time, but then she's done before I am.
Okay. All right. So the procedure goes. Obviously, it worked because you're speaking with me this morning. So tell me what you remember when you finally woke up.
I had a bit of a rocky recovery. Thankfully, Christina did exceptionally well. But the first thing I remember waking up to was my doctor asking me to turn on my side and trying to wake me up, and me just really struggling to wake up, and then him telling me that I was going back into surgery.
Wow.
I'm told this was several days after my surgery.
Really? Wow. Or at least so you don't remember. You were out for several days then, right?
Yes. Or if I was awake, I was not cognizant. What happened was I had I was bleeding internally. That is something that can happen and is fairly common at the connection site. If there's some sort of leak per se. So they had to go in again and fix that. That caused a hematoma, which is like a collection of blood in my abdomen. Actually, there were a few of them, and some infection and some other complications. And for a while after that, I was fighting rejection.
Okay. Is that normal for the body to reject the new liver?
It can happen. It's not very common in the sense that I experienced it. For several weeks, I was very ill and on very high doses of steroids and immunosuppressants and antibiotics and stuff to try and, as they tried to figure out the problem and tried to fix it for me. It can happen that people have complications. We're told beforehand that it's up and down with it, your recovery. It's not usually completely smooth sailing, although it can be. In my case, I was told that pretty much everything that could go wrong did. So I was going through procedures every single day, tests, everything that you could think of, biopsies, things just to try and figure this out and figure out how they could help me to survive. I went into one procedure and they actually nicked two of my arteries while I was under.
Wow.
So a our procedure turned into an emergency operation to try and control the bleeding and to fix this. And I was told by my doctor after the fact that the only patient that they had that had had that procedure and had an artery nicked, only one artery didn't survive.
Oh my goodness.
So it was a miracle that I survived that. I was very lucky that the doctors are amazing where I was, and they took very good care of me and fixed me up.
They did. So how much time has, well, I imagine it would have. So how many days now have you been in the hospital at this point? At least a couple, right?
I had been there for about 2 weeks before this.
2 weeks. Okay.
And then this happened and I didn't actually wake up per se for probably about a week after that. I was a little bit in and out, but I was also having some hallucinations and things. I was not really with it or lucid. I was I had some psychosis from the medications and everything. So it was probably about a week after that transplant or that that surgery before I woke up again.
Now, where was Christina this whole time? How long was it for her to recover?
She was in the hospital for about, I want to say it was like 5 days.
Okay.
Before she was allowed to go home. They actually sent her home the soonest that they allow any living donor to go home. It's usually like a week to a week and a half before they can go home. And typical for the recipient is usually about 2 weeks before they go home. So Christina was sent home and she did famously. She just had a really great recovery, which just is what you would hope for. You know, it's just amazing. So I'm so thankful for that, that it was, you know, I'm sure challenging for her to recover from this, but that she had pretty much the easiest and best possible outcome.
Yeah. Wow. So I want to come back to you. So Christina today, so how long would it take for that 1/3 of liver to grow back to full size? You said it was fairly quick, right?
Yeah, it takes up to 12 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. So within a couple months, we would both have fully grown liver. So currently we both have fully grown, full size functioning livers.
Okay. So this is sound like a really weird question. Do you feel like a different connection to her now that you have essentially her liver inside of you?
You know, we always joked that we were family before this and now we are, you know, connected on a deeper level for sure. It's
okay.
When you literally have somebody physically inside of you, and somebody has done such a selfless act that has literally saved your life. You know, that person is going to be with you forever and you're going to feel a connection to them forever. So we already had this really special relationship and now it's an even deeper relationship.
Wow. That's great. Well, I'll tell you what a good friend to have. That is amazing. So Nicole, you're still in the hospital, you're recovering. At what point does the doctor say, okay, you are good to go home now?
I was sent home about a month after surgery, right before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And I was excited to be able to go home. They felt that I was well enough at that time. I was home for about a week, and then I was back in the hospital for a short span of time. I was something fairly common that happens. I was having a very challenging time eating. So I was not able to consume the amount of protein and nutrition that I needed to. After a liver transplant, you have to consume really high levels of protein. So they gave me protein shakes and things because that's what's going to help you with your recovery. And I was not able to consume this. So I was back in the hospital. I was given a feeding tube. I was there for about a week before they felt that I was stable again enough to go home. This time I went home and it stuck.
Good. Okay.
So I was able to go home, and then probably about a week after I went home, they were able to finally remove the feeding tube. It seemed to have done the trick, basically. At this point at home, I'm still on large amounts of medication. I still have a drain in my side. I still have a PICC line for an IV in my arm where I'm giving myself IV antibiotics. I have visiting nurse, visiting physical therapist, and I'm also in quarantine.
Yeah. So I guess, what does that mean? Did you have a room that nobody could go in without wearing gloves and mask and all that? Or how did it work in your house? Because I can imagine with your twins, they'd probably be wanting to go in there every 5 seconds to see you.
Yes, it was challenging at first. We had a spare bedroom that we set up for me that we had cleaned specifically for me and everything. And basically, if anybody wanted to see me, initially, nobody was allowed to come visit, but my family obviously needed to be there to take care of me. So they had to, you know, wash their hands and everything before coming in to see me. If I saw anybody beyond that, they would have to wear like gloves and a mask, or I would have to wear a mask. And again, with the washing of the hands, and I was only allowed to have two people come see me at a time. And I wasn't allowed to go out into public places at all. The only place I was allowed to go to initially was clinic, where I had to go for my doctor's appointments.
And how often did you have to go to the doctor then?
Initially, 3 times a week.
Oh my goodness. Wow. I bet that was a challenge too, taking you out in the car. And yeah, I mean, you couldn't stop. Hey, I'm going to stop in here and get a pack of cigarettes on the way. You couldn't do anything like that, huh?
Yeah, no, it was hard. Yeah, it was exhausting. Basically, you know, you're tired and you're recovering and you're in pain and you are having to maintain all of these things at the same time. You have to maintain, you know, your sterile environment. You have to, I remember, you know, my husband sitting at the foot of my bed going through like a 10-page document of all of my medications and counting them out and making sure that he's giving me the right dose each day. You know, having to keep my drains and my PICC line and stuff really clean and, you know, deal with those daily, everything. It was a lot. It was a lot to do. But it filled the time, that's for sure. I wasn't bored.
What did you do during, because how long did you have to be in quarantine for? How many months was it?
Initially, it was 3 months.
Three months. Okay. So for 3 months, then what did you do? Did you read a lot of books or?
Yeah. I'm an avid reader. I also enjoy writing and whatnot. But probably what filled the majority of my time was sleeping, honestly. I did a lot of sleeping. And then after the initial 3 months, then you can start slowly venturing out into the world. And I was, you know, wearing a mask and gloves when I was going into stores or anything like that. Because it's the first like 6 months, basically, is like the most pivotal part of your recovery. And you have to be extremely careful during that time. You even have a lot of restrictions on what you can eat and cleaning your food and whatnot. You know, I wasn't initially allowed to have like fresh fruits and vegetables, things like that. No shellfish, no, I'll never be able to eat grapefruit ever again.
Grapefruit? No.
Yeah. It has some sort of enzyme in it that interacts with anti-rejection medication. So one of the things I had to sign off on before transplant was that I wouldn't eat grapefruit ever again. So I think it's a small price to pay. Boy,
if they said no bacon, well, then we'd have problems. Wow. Yeah, well, I don't know anybody that sits there and just eats grapefruit, you know, anyway. So I guess it could be worse, huh? Although I bet now you want grapefruit as bad as I want bacon, huh?
Actually, it's not too bad because you are allowed all of the other citrus fruits. So I was a fan of grapefruit, but I will definitely survive without it.
Well, in solidarity for you, I promise never to eat grapefruit. How's that sound?
Oh, great. Thank you so much. That makes me feel
do what I can. I'm awesome. Not as giving it your husband, but I'll take one for the team. How's that?
All right.
Team
sounds
Nicole.
Great.
All right. So you are quarantine. It's just about over. You're ready to take off the mask and attack the world. And then tell us what happened.
COVID-19.
No story in 2020 will ever begin without some reference to COVID-19. And yet, of all the things that happened to you, Nicole, here's one more on top of it. What happened?
I had just returned to work. I was finally getting back to my normal life and actually having energy and enjoying things so immensely. It was an amazing feeling. And then we were told we would be working from home because we had, this threat of this pandemic that was occurring. I was already living in a world where I was afraid to touch things. And I kind of felt like almost like the world was trying to get me a little bit, you know? You just kind of look at things a little differently when you're immunosuppressed and immunocompromised. And, you know, like, do I want to touch that box in the store? Or, you know, can I go to that event because there's going to be 18 people in a small room? You know, it's challenging. So I was just starting to kind of break free of that. And then we were sent home and I obviously was nervous and trying to do everything that I could to prevent it. My whole family did, to the point where, because my husband was still working, he and I were sleeping in separate bedrooms, just because he had exposure and I didn't. And then he got COVID.
Oh my gosh. So how did he have symptoms and then go get a test, or how did he know?
Yeah, he came home one day. It was a Thursday. He said, I'm not feeling well. I'm coming home early. And he was having some symptoms of that were aligned with COVID. So he went straight upstairs to his room, closed the door, called his doctor. His doctor sent him for testing. And it came back positive. At this point, we were separated within the home. He stayed in upstairs. I stayed downstairs. I stayed in my room mostly. He stayed in his room mostly. I called my transplant team. I asked them, what do I do? And they said that you could maintain that, but like be extremely cautious, be cleaning a lot, whatnot. Obviously, my team was real during this time and still is very concerned about me catching this because this is very dangerous for me. We had the twins living at my in-laws during this time because I couldn't take care of them by myself, and I couldn't quarantine them within the home. I couldn't separate us enough to maintain that. But I stayed home with Peter to help him and just make sure that he wasn't alone within, you know, my situation that we had set up to make sure that I was safe. My in-laws who were watching the twins also got COVID.
Oh, no. Wow.
And then the children were tested and one of my children came back positive and the other came back negative, but they were both exposed to it and they were both asymptomatic. Thankfully, the children did not get sick at all, but they were little carriers. Now my in-laws are both extremely ill from this disease, and they can't watch the children anymore. My husband's starting to feel better. Thankfully, he had a pretty mild case, and the kids had to return to my house. So I went to live in a hotel.
So how long did you stay in the hotel?
I was there for 3 weeks.
Oh, my goodness. Now, did you have people looking after you there? Or, I mean, could you have any come in? Because you couldn't even have the maids come in there and clean, I guess, could you?
No. Yeah, they didn't have any sort of housekeeping. Their restaurant, room service, all that was closed. They were actually only taking people who had to self-isolate because of, you know, a condition like mine, or essential workers who had to travel. So there were times that they would call me from the front desk and say, like, I remember Easter, I was there on Easter. The front desk called me and said, hi, I just want to say happy Easter. You're the only one here. So I figured I'd say hi. So it was kind of a ghost town. And I just kind of maintained things myself. You know, I ordered food to be delivered. I was told by my transplant team, I could have like hot food delivered. You know, I remember going into my room with my cleaning supplies, even though the room was already clean, you know, I sanitized it and everything. And then just, stayed there for the most part, other than, you know, maybe going for a drive or, you know, going to pick up food or something like that. I was pretty much there all the time.
So let's see, Easter was back in April. So at what point were you able to go back home? So your in-laws, your one child, Peter, has everybody recovered now?
Yes, everybody's doing well. Everybody's great. My mother-in-law probably got it the most severe. She had a lot of trouble breathing, but she thankfully, they were all able to treat at home. None of them had to be hospitalized. And there are still a little bit of repercussions from it. My husband still gets some tightness in his chest, and still he has an inhaler now currently for, you know, if he starts to get short of breath, because it causes scar tissue in the lungs that it's going to take a long time for that to heal. So my mother-in-law also has some of those repercussions, and my father-in-law is doing very well, thankfully.
Okay. So bring us to today. I spoke with you last week. We had a virtual meeting, which is when I found all this out and why I insisted we talk on the show. What's the future look like for you now?
Right now, we are, you know, continuing our precautions until further notice. You know, the world around us is starting to reemerge. You know, businesses are opening again. People are venturing out more. And we're kind of staying put. You know, we have to be so cautious with my conditions and my suppression that, you know, we'll still be continuing these things for the foreseeable future. You know, the wearing of masks, the washing, incessant washing of hands, and, you know, all of these procedures and precautions to make sure that I don't get sick.
So, Nicole, I have a couple questions as we wind this down. What is your message to the person that has PSC right now and feels like things are not looking really good for them? What would you tell them?
I would tell them that they're not alone. You know, it's a very rare disease, so it's often hard to feel like you're not absolutely alone in this. There are people out there who are going through this also and who are here to support you and help you. And, you know, for anybody who's chronically ill or immunosuppressed, like, we're here. It's a community. We are all dealing with this, that we're all pushing through it, and we will push through it, and we will come out and things will be great. You know, there's hope. There's positive energy out there. Just try and absorb that and hang on to that and keep pushing through. I think I was faced with a lot of opportunities where I could have given up, or I could have said, I can't do this anymore. But I chose to keep pushing, and I chose to focus on the positive and that light at the end of the tunnel. And it does eventually come, and you will eventually see it, and you can get through this.
And what would you tell the person who is now interested in being a living donor? Or maybe more importantly, the person that just says, I don't know if I could ever do that for somebody. What would you tell them?
I would tell them to research it, look into it, see what it's all about. You know, there's thousands and thousands of people waiting for transplants. And, you know, I think it's something like 18 people a day don't make it waiting. And if these transplants can happen to help people to survive, I mean, it's just amazing. So if you feel that you're somebody who could possibly do this, look into it and see if once you've learned all the facts, it's still something you'd like to do. And if you decide it's not right for you, then you've learned this knowledge that you can then pass on to other people. I think one of the greatest things that can happen is for this to become more known. I think there are other countries out there that don't even do deceased donor transplants, because living donor transplants have become so part of their culture that somebody needs a transplant, somebody just automatically steps up and says, sure, I'll do it. And they schedule it that way. Our country and our society doesn't necessarily know about this as much. I would love to see a day where people don't have to advocate for themselves and try to seek this out by themselves, where they can say, I need a liver transplant. And the doctor can say, well, we have this list of people, so let's check and see if one is a match for you.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Well, aside from you, the real hero of the story too is Christina. And I think that's probably the closest example I have ever seen of someone who is a true friend. And so, man, one day I'd love to have her on the show as well.
This has become
kind of a passion for you now, and you are currently still working, but I know you told me that you're thinking about how to get this message out to the world. Aside from just our interview here, what do you see in the future for you for this particular cause?
You know, I would love to tell my story if it will help people, if, you know, it will educate people on things that they didn't know about that maybe will help save somebody else's life. Or maybe they can take something positive away from it, some sort of message. So I would like to, and I've already started the process of having different networks that I can use to tell my message. So I will be starting a YouTube channel. I'd like to eventually start a podcast. I'd like to write a book, and I'd like to be a speaker. I've spoken at a few things. I've been on a few radio shows, podcasts, etc., but I'd like to really make this bigger. I want to tell this to as many people as I possibly can to get this message out and hopefully help save some lives.
Yeah, I think so. Is there at least an email address that the listeners can use to connect with you and have you come out and tell your story?
Absolutely. My current email address, and you can absolutely use my personal email address, is my name, Nicole Marie Bard @gmail.com. And I would be more than happy to talk to anybody who has questions, who wants to tell me their story, wants to hear more about my story or more about transplants, or chronic illness, any sort of aspect of this that maybe touched them in some way.
That's great. Well, you are a true inspiration, Nicole. I don't care how bad your day is today. It is nowhere close to some of the darkest days that you've experienced, Nicole. And yet you were here on the other side, willing to help others. We are grateful for you and so thankful you could be on the show with us today.
Thank you so much. I hope that everybody got something out of me telling my story.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the HR Oxygen Podcast. We hope you found something today that will relieve your stress, feed your soul, and pump you up to face another day. At Boss Builders, we want to let you know that we appreciate the hard work you do every day as an HR professional. And as a reminder, always make sure to adjust your own oxygen mask before attempting to help those around you. Be well.